This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest-running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Hot traveling fanboys. When you hear this show, you better run for cover.
Klondike Bill's a sausage lover.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboys. It's a weekly podcast and you better listen.
They keep your ears in mint condition.
Hard traveling fanboys in the his house. Nick, can you give us a little Conan?
Oh, no, I don't even remember the Conan shtick. I was never a Conan guy, unless it was pink and green neon United States champion Conan. White meat babyface Conan I can get behind, but Conan with actual personality does nothing for me.
You know, that's fair enough. And much like the NWO Wolfpack, could argue that we jumped the shark a long time ago. But nevertheless, we're back, folks, here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, where we meet once a week in our LJ studios and then immediately fly back to Alabama. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is Nick Duke. And we are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we are bringing to you another edition of our listicle show. Everybody loves listicles, right?
Listicles. That's good
this
stuff.
One is called Countdown, and this one is all about the Marvel Universe on Netflix. Nick, this is something that's been in the works for a while, and we're doing this one to celebrate the release of the brand new Netflix series, The Defenders.
Defenders is something that I think a lot of us have been looking forward to for a long time. I myself was planning on I was hoping to have it finished by now, but circumstances and life have gotten in the way, and I've been able to watch two episodes to this point. But granted, two episodes that I very much enjoyed. I can't, you know, I have to finish the last six, but I will say those two episodes alone are better than the entirety of Iron Fist. So at least we're not looking at an Iron Fist type situation with the Defenders here. But yeah, like Greg said, we figured with kind of phase one of the Marvel Netflix universe coming to a close, no better time than the present to go ahead and take a look back at our favorite episodes from the four seasons of television that have been – or five seasons of television that have been leading up into Defenders.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that we're not going to get an Iron Fist situation. We may, however, get an Oli Fist situation.
Ooh.
So we'll keep you updated on that. And by the way, I received – and I didn't want to air our grievances on the air, but, you know, I have to bring this up, Nick, because you don't even know about this yet. I just have gotten the word from our insider, our industry insider, United States Anti-Doping Association. I have just received word that, folks, I don't know how else to put this, and maybe I should do this off the air, but Nick Duke failed a test last week for performance enhancing drugs before the episode.
What drug? What drug?
I don't know. They haven't said.
Fake news, sir.
I don't. I'm just saying, Nick. I'm going to give you a chance to explain yourself. Was it a tainted supplement?
No.
Were you just trying to get a leg up on the conversation last week?
Your Honor, it weren't me.
Are you or are you not from the city of Geneva?
Quite frankly, that's neither here nor there.
Nevertheless, I'll keep you guys updated on what the panel finds. Understand that Nick is due his due process. He's got the finest representatives in the world. You know, I'm on his side, of course. And we're going to get to the bottom of how this could have happened. And
Clarence Mason is working on my case.
We've got Clarence Mason and the Mr. McMahon lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Looking into this situation, Jerry McNevin, of course,
quite frankly, I am not aware of any Mr. McMahon lawyer, sir.
Mr. McMahon.
There we go. That's more like it.
Lawyer. And Jerry McDevitt is heading up the entire team. So I feel like we're in pretty good legal shape here.
Well, the only issue with that is that McDevitt doesn't even know what a podcast is and denies its very existence. So that could be a problem.
He doesn't even know what is. It's all quite confusing and strange. But what we are here to talk about.
You know, I just realized, Greg, that Jerry McDevitt is like the Lawrence Bowden of attorneys. Like,
my God, he really is. He looks like it to a degree.
He just kind of talks and rambles and asks like unrelated, nonsensical questions until you just get frustrated and give up. Like that's his entire legal strategy. The firm of Bowden and McDevitt.
Coming to a civil case near you, Bowden and McDevitt.
Nobody that's listening to this, literally no one except us, will have any idea what we've been talking about for like the last 5 minutes. So why don't we move on?
That is a wonderful point. Well, we're here to talk about the Nick mentioned the five seasons of television that have taken place here in the Marvel Cinematic Universe on Netflix, rather.
Let's just call it the Marvel Netflix Universe to avoid alphabet soup and whatnot.
Right, the Marvel Netflix Universe, quite frankly. And that encompasses Daredevil Season 1, Jessica Jones Season 1, Daredevil Season 2, Luke Cage Season 1, and Iron Fist Season 1, culminating, of course, with Defenders. So without any further ado, Nick, do you want to start off the list or should I?
I'll let you go right ahead and lead off.
Well, I am going to kick us off with an episode called Speak of the Devil. Mm-hmm. This comes to us from Season 1 of Daredevil, and it is Episode 9. And this is probably the best to this point fight-centered episode in the entirety of the Marvel Netflix universe.
Is this the Nobu episode?
This is the Nobu episode. Yep.
Yeah. This is one that I heavily considered for my list, but ultimately had make. I think it was in like my 10, and it was one of the five I had to cut. But good choice on your part.
Thank you. Yes, this is our introduction. Not our introduction, but this is where we find out what a badass Nobu is. Nobu, of course, is a representative of the Hand. And the episode is shot and framed in such a compelling way. From the minute this episode starts, we're thrown into this fight, this episode-long fight between Daredevil and Nobu. And the fight is what frames everything that happens within the episode. We see evolution of the Wilson Fisk storyline as Fisk continues trying to manipulate things and set up this hit on Daredevil. Matt Murdock, that is, of course, meets with Father Lantum to try to get to the spiritual center of what's going on with him. He's more with Ben Urich, meeting with Karen Page and Foggy Nelson. But all of that stuff is really not what makes this episode great. What makes this episode great is that framing sequence, the fight, the episode-long, hour-long fight between Nobu and Daredevil, because it is vicious. It is one of the most intense and visceral fights I've ever seen in superhero fiction, not just television, but television or movies. We don't see stuff like this in superhero films a lot where you see the hero really take an ass-kicking.
I was about to say, my memory of that is that it's very like brutal in terms of like Matt is able to win the fight basically by luck alone because he gets his ass handed to him for the better part of what feels like 20 minutes or so.
Absolutely. Nobu has this like I don't even know what you would call it, this almost scythe-type thing that's on a rope. Or a chain, and he's swinging it around, and he is just cutting. It's death by a thousand cuts as he's just cutting up Matt constantly with this chain. And at times, you find yourself wondering, holy crap, how is Matt going to get out of this? Somebody's going to have to come rescue him. Luckily, Matt, like Nick mentioned, he gets a little here in this fight and comes out on the winning side in brutal fashion. But it's hard to say he even wins because he's left in such a state of disrepair afterwards that you wonder how he's ever going to possibly recover. And were it not for the help of his friend Clear, he wouldn't recover. But this episode so brilliantly ties its subplots together within the story of this fight as it's going on, as Matt's trying to, first of all, survive, and then trying to figure out his style, and then trying to counter, and then, of course, trying to survive again. It goes full circle. It's a great scene, great fight. And to me, this is representative of the best parts of Daredevil, the action show, which, you know, that's for another show for us to debate whether it gets away from that too much. But I think that Daredevil is at its best when we get these intense action sequences, and especially in season one. I feel like in season two, the fights went down in scale a little bit. But here, this is season one almost at its peak.
Yeah, like I said, this was one that I heavily considered. I remember that Nobu fight standing out very well in my mind. You know, for some of these episodes that we're going to discuss here, it's been a little while since I've seen them, and so I was kind of having to go off my best memory. But that was definitely one that left a lasting impression and was very difficult to cut. So I'm glad to hear you gave it some love. Very much enjoyed that one, and Nobu is one of the cooler hand-to-hand threats they presented thus far in the Netflix universe.
Totally. So what's your number five, my friend?
Well, my number five, this will come as no surprise to you, Greg, comes from Jessica Jones season one, and it's the episode entitled AKA You're a Winner. And this is an episode that sees so a couple episodes before this one, Luke and Jessica had kind of broken things off because Jessica had, you know, come to realize that she just couldn't deal with the guilt of what had happened to Luke's wife, and she felt responsible, and she couldn't lie to him, essentially. And so they've kind of been apart for a couple episodes, and here Luke shows back up asking for Jessica's help with this case. And this all comes in the middle of Jessica trying to deal with the Kilgrave situation and trying to forward, you know, move the investigation into him forward, trying to clear the name of Hope Schlottman, you know, who was the young girl from early in the season who was ordered to kill her own parents by Kilgrave and is now imprisoned for that crime. But over the course of this episode, we start to see Luke and Jessica trying not to be sexually charged towards one another. We see them trying to be platonic friends. And what's really cool about this episode is you see both of them starting to acknowledge in these little nonverbal, subtle ways that there is just an undeniable chemistry between the two. And that you kind of watch them come back together and start to build the foundation of something that could be a lasting relationship, you know, not rather than just something totally, totally based around kinky sex as it is near the beginning of their relationship. But while all this is going on, you've got some really cool stuff with Hope in the prison as they reveal that ultimately that she is pregnant with Kilgrave's child and that she actually paid another inmate to beat her up in hopes of causing an abortion. So you've got Jessica dealing with that. You've got the scene where Trish Walker actually calls out Kilgrave on her radio show, calls him impotent and starts insulting him, prompting him to call in one of the great scenes in the entire season and just be overly menacing and threatening while sounding so polite and like only David Tennant can do as Kilgrave. It's an outstanding scene if you remember that one, Greg. But the main reason this one makes my list is the emotional payoff at the end as throughout the episode, it's slowly revealed that Luke is trying to help this woman find her brother, and he's hired Jessica to help him because the woman claims to have information on the night that Luke's wife, Reva, died. And Jessica knows that by helping him, she is risking him finding out the truth. And the way the episode winds up is the information that Luke gets is actually false. He is told that a drunken bus driver is responsible for his wife's death. And Luke sets off to kill this guy, and Jessica knows that he had that bus driver had nothing to do with it. And so she has to wrestle with this guilt. She already feels guilty about killing Reva and about all the things that she did while under Kilgrave's control, but now she's essentially about to have another death on her hands. And not just that, but she knows that she will have Luke's own guilt on her hands as well because she's afraid that he will regret what he has done and the kind of man it could send him down the path to being. And so ultimately we get the big payoff at the end with Jessica confessing to Luke what happened and him telling her that she is, quote, a piece of shit and walking away from her. And it's just such a perfect character arc and story arc for this one episode of Jessica Jones. It shows why, you know, she is so conflicted and so emotionally traumatized, because every time it feels like she has something good in her life, it inevitably turns to shit. And she feels like she's directly responsible for everything bad that has happened to her. And it kind of helps the audience to further understand just why she has such a hard time relating to others, because it seems like every time she gets close to somebody, she feels like she does something to screw it up. And all that is outstanding, but the closing shot of the episode is actually the moneymaker, as it is revealed that over the course of the episode, Kilgrave has been silently plotting in the background, and what he has done is he has purchased Jessica's childhood home, and that is where the episode ends, as we are left wondering what he's going to do with that. And not to tell tales out of skewl, but I may be discussing the follow-up to that later on in this very show.
Yeah, I'm glad you put this episode on. This was a stretch of Jessica Jones where, to me, it really hit its stride. It was good early on, but it really hit its stride probably 4 to 5 episodes in and then never really looked back from there. It was just episode after episode of monumental revelations and action-packed sequences and an evolving mystery and revealing backstory through actions and through subtlety rather than through beating you over the head with stuff. Really good stretch of episodes from Jessica Jones here. Glad that that made your list.
Also very good, Greg. Let's not forget Hogarth's assistant Pam. Good touch on the show, I found.
You liked the way that was going?
I saw some value in it. I thought there was some interesting storytelling places they could take it.
Did you feel like maybe Patty could have or Patsy could have?
You know,
possibly,
that's a great point. She and Pam never really got to interact, and I think there's a lot of potential there.
I think you may be onto something. I'm interested in your ideas and would like to subscribe to your newsletter. Mm-hmm. For me, I am going to for my number 4 entry, I am going to the most recent episode that I've watched that will be on my list, and it was tough to narrow down because I really enjoyed the first 3 episodes of Luke Cage, but this one to me really stood out, and that is the very first episode of Luke Cage called Moment of Truth. To me, of all of the shows on the Marvel Netflix universe, this was the best debut episode of all of them. This was the one that it hit the ground running. It didn't have to be an action-packed episode per se, but the way that it introduced its characters, the way that it dropped you into the story, the way that it made me care over the course of this episode about so many of these different characters that I had never met before outside of Luke Cage was brilliant. I thought that Michael, I believe is the name of the guy that plays Luke Cage. Is that correct, Nick?
Yes, that's correct.
He has such a of all of the Netflix characters, the one to me that comes off like the most irrepressibly good guy is Luke Cage. With Daredevil, there's that sense there's always that sense of self-deprecation maybe, but and he's a good guy certainly, but there's also a sense of almost arrogance at times. And with Jessica, of course, there's the cynicism and the character flaws and all that. But with Luke, he's just a good guy who's trying to do right by those around him and just trying to fade into the background. And in the process of fading into the background, we get to meet all of these people at this barbershop that is run by this character named Pop. And yes, I'm a huge mark for Coming to America, as everybody knows that knows me. But it's not just the memories of Coming to America, but it's the fact that it puts you into a barbershop that could be in any – virtually any community in this country that's a moderately big city. And it just drops you into this barbershop as people are having the normal conversations that dudes have at barbershops. It's about sports. It's about music. It's about TV, it's movies, it's stuff that dudes talk about, and there was no it wasn't forced. It was contemporary stuff, you know, talking about Carmelo Anthony and Phil Jackson, and it was contemporary conversations that people would have, and they were so natural, and it made me care about these people. Even the people like what's his name, Shamik, who is very arrogant, and you just want Luke to knock him out in the first few minutes of this episode, and he ends up getting a fate worse than Luke knocking him out. He gets beaten to death, as it turns out, later in the episode. But he's a kid that, you know, he has an identifiable character, and he comes off real. The people in this episode come off real. The politician comes off real. And it introduces us to a brand new villain in the Netflix Marvel Universe, and that is Cottonmouth. And he is spectacular. The actor Mahershala Ali probably is the standout in this episode. He is untouchable in terms of his cool factor and his charisma, and just even when he's not saying anything, he says so much with his eyes. It's incredible. We meet Misty Knight, Simone Missick, who has tons of personality and charisma. She's great. Theo Rossi as Shades, who's this really like mysterious villain character that you don't really find out much about his backstory until several episodes later. Frankie Faison plays Pop, and I've recently learned that he's been in a lot of movies. He was in Coming to America, appropriately yes. enough, which ties it all together.
And Silence of the Lambs.
Silence of the Lambs. Kind of a veteran character actor who's popped up in some of the least likely spots. And appropriate enough, he runs a barbershop here, and he was in Coming to America as the landlord. So a great character actor. The casting in this show is phenomenal. The music, good Lord, the music in this episode was dynamic. It was Rafael Sadiq, who does a great job with his music in this episode. It really sucked me into the whole feel, the vibe of the episode, which is something Luke Cage does very well, at least four episodes in. That's as far as I've gotten. So, yeah, this episode basically sets up Luke's personality, who his side characters are going to be, what his relationship with Misty Knight's going to be potentially, and the fact that she's not being completely upfront with him from the get-go about who she is and what she does. The viciousness of Cottonmouth, where he'll be so calm one minute, but like almost like the Kingpin in some ways. He can turn on that viciousness very easily, and he has this feeling of disrespect that he seems to feel constantly. So I just really enjoyed this episode, Nick. I thought it set the table very, very well and left me thinking about it for several days after I watched it. And still, four episodes in, this is the best episode of Luke Cage that I've seen to this point.
Yeah, I think you got a couple more that are coming up that'll probably rank pretty highly for you. And then you got a big drop-off in the back half of the season, in my opinion. But glad to hear that, you know, you started Luke Cage and that it did influence your list. So I will go ahead and tell a little bit of Tales Out of Skule. That will be the only – you'll be the only one with some Luke Cage episodes on the five, because I did not have any Luke Cage in my top five. But moving on. And I'm going to go back to Daredevil Season 1 like Greg did earlier, but I'm going to go to a different episode. And I'm going to go to an episode called In the Blood. And this is the first episode where we really get to spend a lot of time with Wilson Fisk. And we get to spend time with Wilson Fisk as he is wooing this art dealer, Vanessa. And anybody who is a big fan of the Marvel Universe and the comics knows that one of the things that's always driven the Kingpin is this love for his wife. I know a lot of times she's been portrayed as terminally ill and him trying to find cures for her disease and that sort of thing. But here we almost get the origin of that relationship, which is something I've never really read in the comics or thought to even think of. And it's really interesting to see how this it's clear that this version of the Kingpin is not someone who is incapable of feeling human emotion or seeking out a human connection, and it really helps to humanize him as we see him like awkwardly stumble through this dating situation. But all the while that that's going on, we also get a lot of really interesting stuff with the rest of the cast. As you know, Matt is trying to figure out exactly how best to serve the city, how best to figure out who is behind this, you know, labyrinthine-like plot that he's starting to uncover. You've also got Karen Page who and Ben Urich who are working together on this Union-Allied story. Karen begins to act rashly, and Ben is trying to kind of take her under his wing, and show her the ropes a little bit when it comes to investigative journalism, something that would, you know, play off for the character down the road. And of course,
and most importantly, he's trying to teach her how to cry.
Now, good sir, I'll remind you that I let your Misty Knight is really interesting thing, I let it go without comment, but you just can't help yourself when it comes to Karen Page. Especially season one Karen Page, who doesn't even have anything to really complain about. So why don't you just take your comments and shut up? But that's okay. We're going to move on. Anyway, so over the course of this episode, we've also got the edict from Wilson Fisk and Madame Gao and the other associates in this criminal empire. They tell the Russians to kind of deal with the Daredevil problem, to stop him interfering with shipments and business dealings, that sort of thing. And they try to do that by reaching out and trying to harm the one person they know that Daredevil has an association with, that being Claire Temple. And so this is the episode where Claire is abducted by the Russians, and we get this awesome scene of Matt infiltrating the taxi company in the dark and taking down everyone and getting Claire out of there. And as a result of that, we see the Russians realizing that they can't do this on their own, and they basically are willing to turn over their entire operation to Wilson Fisk in exchange for him taking care of the Daredevil problem. The mistake they make, however, is they interrupt Wilson's first date with Vanessa. And Greg, I think you remember the ending of this scene as the Russian brother is told he is put into a car where he is told he's going to be taken to a meeting with Fisk where they can hash out the finer details of this agreement. And instead, he is brutally beaten to death and his head is liquefied in a car. And it's one of the most brutal things in the entire in the entirety of the Marvel Netflix universe to this point, but it's also one that just gets over how intimidating and how brutal of a villain Wilson Fisk can be when pushed, and that he's not an entirely intellectual and financial threat. And I just absolutely loved it. I thought of all the episodes, this is the one that really gets across who Wilson Fisk is and why he's going to be a big, big problem for Daredevil as the season builds.
Now, this episode was the last one I cut down. This would have been my number six if I were putting together a top 10 list. This is a great episode. Like you said, the brutality was something we had never seen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And still, to this day, I would say one of the most violent scenes we've seen in a Marvel property. And really got across that this is a underneath his exterior, underneath the suave businessman, this is a street thug underneath all of that. And he is bubbling with rage, bubbling with anger. And when he's frustrated, when he's flustered, and when he's pushed into a corner, he's going to lash out with violence, and he's going to lash out with anger because that's what he's known his whole life and that's what he understands. And if that's not a great summation of the Kingpin as a character, I don't know what is. This is a terrific way to introduce him, really, formally introduce him to the audience, people that may either not have known of him or may have only known of him through the movie that came out, which he was good in the movie too, but this is a much more arguably a more comic book accurate version than what we got in the film, which was also solid. But this is a new introduction for him that is done exceedingly well, and to me set the stage for what was going to be a pretty back and forth tug of war between Daredevil and the Kingpin over the course of season one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what's your number three?
My number three comes to us also from Daredevil season one. And this is going to be season one, episode seven, simply titled Stick. Mm-hmm. This is the episode that introduced us to the titular character, Stick.
I prefer titular, personally.
I know you prefer titular, but I can't say titular without giggling, so I'm going to go with titular. Or breastular, if you prefer.
Yeah, I like that better.
Let's go with that. The breastular character of Stick, played by Scott Glenn, who is a terrific veteran actor of action films. He's been a genre guy most of his career and has turned in lots of great performances. He is phenomenal here. To this day, Nick, to this point in the Marvel Netflix universe, he is one of my favorite characters that we've been introduced to this point. Every time he has shown up on screen to this point, business has picked up, quite frankly. And he has signaled first of all, a ramp up in the action, which I always appreciate. And second of all, a much needed slap in the face for Matt Murdock at times. And a departure from where I feel Daredevil at times gets in the weeds a little bit with the navel gazing and whining at times. I love it when Stick shows up, because that means shit's about to hit the fan again, and Matt's going to be confronted with some harsh truths. And in this episode in particular, we get the backstory. We meet Stick and we find out what happened to Matt after his dad was killed while he was at the orphanage. And unfortunately, my computer just warned me that it wants to install an update to Adobe Acrobat, which I'm not interested in. Nevertheless, Matt Murdock as a child and Stick have this very strange bond, and it becomes apparent that even though Stick, you could argue, is abusive to Matt, he gives him a choice to rock himself to sleep at night and feel sorry for himself, or to be trained to use his newfound abilities to fight a war. At one point, child Matt gives Stick a present, a bracelet that is it's basically a paper bracelet that he's been made, that was made of an ice cream bar that Stick bought for him back when they first met. Stick does not like emotions very much and abruptly stopped their training and left the city as soon as this happened. Like, basically, they had been working together for some time and training, and Matt was growing attached to Stick, gave him this sentimental gift, and that caused Stick to abandon him. So it's created a bit of a harsh reaction between them. Matt now resents Stick for taking him in and then abandoning him and basically, without saying this, making him lose his father for a second time. And on Stick's side, it seems apparent that he doesn't view Matt as a son. He just viewed him as a means to an end. In fact, there's a quote in this episode where Stick says, "You wanted a father and I wanted a soldier." And then Matt says, "And I guess we were both disappointed," which is a great little line. But then for all of their fighting and all of their emotional prodigal, almost a prodigal father, I guess you would say, where the prodigal father returns to the son, and the son doesn't welcome him with open arms, and they fight, and they argue, and they bicker, and Stick tries to recruit him back to the cause, and Matt flirts with that for a portion of the episode, and then ultimately decides that he can't do that. He's not going to kill a child, which is what Stick wants him to do, because the child is a weapon. And Matt fights Stick, beats him, and tells him to leave New York City. However, as Matt is cleaning up the apartment at the end of the episode after their fight, he finds in the rubble the paper bracelet that he gave Stick all those years ago, which shows that Stick had held on to it all that time, so it did mean something to him. So I'm a sucker for father-son dynamics in fiction, and I always have been, probably always will be, and I really appreciated this episode's ability to go for the jugular in the violence and to go straight for the heart at the end with that revelation. One of my favorite episodes of all time.
Yeah, that was another one that just missed my cut, but I'm glad to hear that it made your list. I'm glad to hear that we got to talk about it a little bit, because it was certainly a fantastic episode. And I would argue as much as I've enjoyed Stick in his subsequent appearances, I don't know that I've ever enjoyed him as much as I did in that very first episode, because it was so well done. Just an outstanding character and one of the more captivating characters in the entire Marvel Netflix universe. But moving on to my number three, and we're going to go back to Jessica Jones season one for an episode entitled AKA It's Called Whiskey. And this is the episode, this is the third episode of Jessica Jones, and it is here where it is finally revealed to us what exactly the relationship between Jessica and Luke's wife's death is. You know, we've gotten big references to it. We've gotten Jessica clearly being conflicted over she and Luke's sexual encounters with one another. We've gotten the scene of her looking at Reva's photo behind Luke's bathroom mirror. We've gotten scenes of her spying on Luke. We've gotten a lot of hints and a lot of, you know, subtlety about around what exactly it is that happened. And here we see it for the first time. And we see it for the first time in flashback form, juxtaposed against the current day story of Luke and Jessica discovering each other's abilities and how they have kind of found kindred spirits in one another. And of course, Greg, when you find a kindred spirit, the thing to do is to screw the ever-living hell out of them for, like, the better part of, like, what seems to be about 4 days. Because these two engage in marathon sex sessions, bed-breaking sex sessions. At one point, they are going at it, and Jessica rips a radiator pipe off the wall using her super strength.
This is a lot like what happened when we first met, Nick, remember?
Yeah, except neither of us are strong enough to rip radiator pipes off the wall. And we did break the bed, but it was just due to our weight. Not due to any superpowers or whatnot, which is why we had
– And by a marathon sex session, it lasted about 15 seconds. But there were portions. You know, it's 15-second bursts every few hours.
That's right. Sprints, not marathons. That's why we have the L-shaped bed now, because it's a lot sturdier than your standard square-shaped bed.
It is. You know, when we asked for it to be built, the people who built it said, hey, does this even make sense? And we said, oh, just trust us.
In any event, but yeah, so you got here these two kind of using their superpowers in ways they probably had never anticipated before.
It's like listeners learning information they never thought they'd hear before.
But yeah, you got that going on. And I actually misspoke earlier, Greg, when I said that scene of Kilgrave calling into Trish's radio show took place in that other episode I talked about. It actually took place in this episode. The reason I got confused is I watched both of these episodes earlier today back to back, and so they kind of got conflated in my mind. But that scene actually takes place here because Jessica is able to convince Trish to talk about the Kilgrave incident and the Kilgrave case and the Schlottman case on her radio show because the public – the media essentially is raking Hope Schlottman over the coals, saying that she's crazy, saying she's a liar, saying she's just another person using the bullcrap, you know, mental illness excuse to try and get out of, you know, paying for what she did and all that. And Jessica is trying to go on the offensive, on the public relations offensive. But in any event, while all this is going on, we are seeing Kilgrave in his new luxury apartment he's installed himself in. We are also seeing Jessica's continued interactions with her weird neighbors, whether it's the crackhead Malcolm or the weird brother and sister duo that live above her that she has some unique interactions with. But we also see her in subtle ways dealing with that guilt over Reva's death. At one point, after she finds, you know, is caught by Luke looking at the photo again, she says to Luke, "I'm sorry," and it's like this look on her face that kind of says to the audience what she's apologizing for is not what Luke thinks she's apologizing for. It gives the scene of this whole other meaning. This notably also has, Greg, one of my favorite scenes in all of the Marvel Netflix universe, the first utterance of "Sweet Christmas" in a Netflix episode, and I thought it was expertly handled as they finish up another raucous sex session and Luke intones "Sweet Christmas." And Jessica goes, "Yeah, I think." Just a fantastic little bit. It's a it's just a great episode. And of course, it ends up with the debut of the character of Will Simpson, as he is a New York City police officer who comes to investigate Trish's apartment. And when she lets him in, he brutally attacks her as he is under the control of Kilgrave. Jessica and Trish are able to fake Trish's death to make him think he is carried out his orders. And so Jessica follows him back to Kilgrave, and it's there, even though Kilgrave is able to escape, we get the reveal that he has been having someone stalk her as she discovers the apartment that he has is covered in photos of her. And it's this really interesting dynamic as the cliffhanger sets up Jessica now seeking to find out who has been following her and who has been stalking her for what seems to be weeks and months on end now. So lots of great stuff in this episode. Lots of revelations as to the exact dynamic between Luke and Jessica. And we see kind of, you know, here for the first time fully what exactly it is that Jessica is dealing with. And that's pretty much why it made my list, because it's kind of integral to the plot of Jessica Jones, which I have made no secret is my favorite of the Netflix series.
Yeah, that was another great episode that almost made my list. That was also on the outside looking in. Glad you mentioned it. It's a great one. I loved the evolving dynamic there between all the characters, Jessica and Luke in particular, and the breaking of the back and the humbling. It was all very good. And I'm going to stick with Jessica Jones for my number two episode of the Marvel Netflix universe. This is actually the only Jessica Jones episode that will be on my list. Even though it is my favorite of the series to this point, I will talk about that a little bit later. That episode is called AKA WWJD. And this is an episode that you made reference to earlier that will be on your list. This comes in at number two for me. This is the episode in which Jessica, as Nick mentioned, revelation is made that Kilgrave has purchased Jessica Jones' childhood home. And this is the episode where he entices Jessica, not through his ability, but just Jessica shows up at the house and agrees to move in with Kilgrave. And it is one of the creepiest episodes of all time, just for the psychological ramifications of what's going on. Kilgrave promises that he will not use his powers on Jessica because he wants her to have free will when she falls in love with him. Keep in mind, this is a guy who has sexually assaulted her. This is a guy who has infiltrated her mind and forced her to do things against her will. To him, he's still convinced she's going to fall in love with him. And there is a dinner party where the waitstaff is threatened. He gets upset. He flies off the handle. There is a tension in this episode that is rarely seen throughout the Marvel Netflix or cinematic universes. It's a tour de force from David Tennant as Kilgrave. And to her credit, Kristen Ritter matches it as Jessica Jones. It's basically – there's some other stuff going on here with Officer Will Simpson, with Trish Walker. But basically what you're seeing is two-person performance here in large part between Ritter and Tennant. And they just knock it out of the park. They kill it. It just delivers in so many ways for me. It's emotional, it's intense, and it's just – it makes your skin crawl at times to watch this episode, because you're trying to figure out what Jessica is really thinking the whole time, if she really has the situation under control. It appears that she actually does. And in the end, Kilgrave is distracted and injected – with a sedative, and she attempts to take out Kilgrave, but unfortunately it gets screwed up and things don't go according to plan. But Nick, I know this episode was, I think I have an idea of where this episode is going to finish for you, but I had to get this one on at my number two position. A tour de force, in my opinion, for the Jessica Jones crew.
Yes, it's an outstanding episode, worthy of every superlative that could possibly throw in its way, and I will have more to say on that in a bit. But my number two episode, interestingly enough, is the episode that directly follows the episode you just mentioned, Greg, because my number two episode is an episode entitled AKA Sinbin. And this is the episode in which, following the events of WWJD, Jessica has Kilgrave unconscious, and she takes him to a hermetically sealed room in the basement of a warehouse, a room where he can neither be seen, he is impossible for anyone to hear him, and thus it keeps his powers from affecting anyone. And what she is intent on doing is getting him to confess on videotape to all the things he's done, to ordering Hope Schlottman to murder her parents, so she's hoping to exonerate Hope as a result of this. And what she does is she covers the floor of the hermetically sealed room with water and an exposed wire, enabling her to basically electrocute and incapacitate Kilgrave at any point if it seems like he is trying to use his powers or is being successful in using his powers on anyone. And along the course of the episode, we see that, you know, she's just not getting anywhere with Kilgrave, and she starts to try a different angle. And so she starts to investigate this yellow USB that Reva Connors had buried in the foundation of that building long ago, as we saw in flashbacks. And on that USB drive are videos that show the experiments that caused Kilgrave to gain his powers, experiments that were being performed on him by his very own parents. And what winds up happening is she is actually able to track down Kilgrave's parents and has them come and confront him. And, you know, this is another episode where there are some other things going on in the background, kind of like WWJD, but really the major crux of this is the emotional fallout of seeing the abuse and the torture that Kilgrave endured as a child and how that could cause him to become so warped. But then you also see the genuine guilt that his parents are dealing with over what they have created and what they drove their own son to be. And then you get this scene with the parents and Kilgrave confronting one another, them going into the hermetically sealed room, and it seeming for just a moment that there's going to be this happy reunion before Kilgrave turns on a dime and ratchets up the menace, unlike any other villain in all the Netflix universe, as he orders his mother to stab herself one time with a pair of scissors for every year it has been since she abandoned him, and then orders his dad to cut out his own heart. Jessica tries to stop all this, but the water and live wire situation she set up is no longer active, and it winds up being this great scene of Kilgrave escaping and him now realizing that there's pretty much nothing he can do to woo Jessica, and that from here on out, they're playing for blood at this point. And it is, of all the Tenet episodes, this is one of the better ones. I think his performance here is as good as it is anywhere else, and that's saying something, as I've made, you know, no secret of the fact that I think he may not just be the best villain in the Marvel Netflix universe, his may be the single best portrayal or performance of any character in any of the shows to this point. So this episode, Sinbin, rates very highly for me and takes home the number two spot on my list.
Thinner. very good, Nick. It's a great episode as well. Tenet was fantastic as Kilgrave to this point in the Marvel pantheon, really. He's right up there with Loki as the very best villains that we have seen to this point. And certainly I am looking forward to seeing more of the character, potentially in Jessica Jones Season 2, albeit possibly in flashback form or through hallucinations. We'll see. But for my number one episode, I am going to, maybe somewhat surprisingly, to a season that I criticized somewhat when I watched it. However, I never will say that it didn't have its highs, because my number one episode, my favorite episode of any of the Netflix shows to this point, Daredevil Season 2, Episode 4, Penny and Dime.
You know, this is a little surprising. I thought for sure you would go with the episode preceded that, Because, you know, neither of these two episodes made my list, but I will say that this one that you're talking about was one of my last cuts, and I was struggling with it, or I forget the name of the one that preceded it, but it's basically a showdown between either the Daredevil Punisher rooftop scene or the Punisher confession scene in the graveyard. And most people praise the rooftop scene, but I actually think this graveyard scene is the best performance that John Bernthal gives in the entire season.
Agreed. I think it's also the best performance that Charlie Cox gives in the entire season. I think it's a masterpiece. And I think – I'll tell you what separated it, Nick, is while I like the rooftop episode, I think – I have issues with the rooftop episode because I think they fundamentally change the scene from the comic, and the scene in the comic works a lot better to me. It's one of those – one of those nerdy, oh, it's not because they changed it, but to me the changes didn't help it. They hurt it. And in this case, Penny and Dime, this just blew me away. And it still does every time I watch it. This is the introduction of a brand new character, an Irish gangster, Finn Cooley, who has a great name, who has heard about the massacre that Frank Castle has committed on the Irish gang there in New York, on the other gangs as well. And he takes it upon himself to hunt down the Punisher. He wants to find out who this guy is and wants to tear him apart. And Castle, meanwhile, is tracking them as well. And I'm not even going to mention the other stuff that goes on in this episode with Karen and you know, there's a funeral that goes on, and Foggy Nelson's there as well. But all that stuff to me is just window dressing, because this episode's about the Punisher. And while I had some issues at times with the characterization of Frank Castle in some of the other episodes, this really won me over. And it won me over not just in the writing, but in the portrayal, like you mentioned, of John Bernthal as the Punisher. This is the episode where I really feel like, okay, I buy him now, Frank Castle. I buy this guy 100% as the number one anti-hero in the Marvel Universe. And this is also notable because it's the only time at this point we get to see Daredevil and the Punisher kind of on the same side briefly. It's easy to forget about this, but you see the Punisher, you know, he gets captured, he gets tortured. Finn Cooley ties him up in this warehouse and this building, and begins just beating him, and they torture him with a drill, which is a devastating scene to watch. I mean, it's really hard to watch. To use wrestling parlance, the selling in that scene is – well, he's telling a story, quite frankly. They pick a body part and they tell a story. And in this case, it's a lot of body parts. And it's Frank Castle's hand that is being drilled, and not in the good way. And he is he's just getting the living daylights beaten out of him. And probably the license to kill as well. And Daredevil has to actually save the Punisher from Finn Cooley and his men. And he finally wins. He finally gets what he wants from Castle, the information of the money, by threatening to torture Frank's dog. That gets Frank. At any time you involve a dog, as people have learned from the John Wick series, the audience is going to care right then. For some reason, there's something about a dog that is almost more sympathetic than seeing humans in peril in film at times. And sure enough, that works here on me every time I watch it. And you just want this Finn Cooley to get his. And he does. So Castle gets free and kills all the other men in the room, asks Cooley who killed his family. And when Cooley laughs and asks who cares, Frank just shoots him in the damn face. And it's awesome, and it is cathartic, and it's something you won't ever get to see in a Batman movie or a Spider-Man movie or even a Daredevil movie. You'll never get to see anything like that from those characters. It's something only the Punisher gets the leeway to do, and it's awesome. And it, you know, because it's nice once in a while, Nick, once in a while to see such an unrepentant bastard as Finn Cooley get what's coming to him. And he gets his face blown off by Frank. Frank fights his way out of the building but is outnumbered. And he's chanting this children's rhyme, this one batch, two batch, penny and dime. And we get a little bit of the story behind that later on. But the reason this episode makes my list is just because this whole sequence was amazing, and it was. To me, it was the best part of the entire season of Daredevil, season two. But in addition to that, we get the incredible scene that Nick referenced at the graveyard as Matt and Frank, with Frank tied up. They're sitting there – or he's tied up. He's just beat up. And they're sitting there at the graveyard, and Frank it kind of explains what happened. He talks about what he's going through and his he apologizes to Daredevil for what happened before between them. And he explains the one batch, two batch thing. And it was reading his daughter her favorite book, promising her that he would read it the following night. He refused to read it, rather, the night that they got killed, and said he would read it the next night. However, the next day, they're at the carousel. They get caught in a gang shootout. Castle shot in the head, but he survives. And it's this moment. It's the first time where Matt finally gets it. Like, he doesn't agree with it, and he'll never agree with it. But he gets why Frank is the way that he is. It's a masterpiece of an episode. It's the high water mark of season two. I don't think the season ever really came close to matching this episode after that. Even though there were a couple good episodes after that for sure, I don't think they ever really came close to matching it. So that's my number one episode, Nick, and this thing, in my view, that the Marvel Netflix universe has put out to this point.
Yeah, I agree. It's a fantastic episode. As I said, it just missed my list, but I'm glad that you had it and had it so highly. And so, of course, moving on to my number one, and as Greg alluded to earlier, it is a.k.a. WWJD. It is from season one of Jessica Jones. As Greg mentioned, he kind of laid it all out for you. You know, the main thrust of the episode, what with Kilgrave purchasing Jessica's childhood home and the two attempting to live together for a time as Kilgrave is trying to convince her to fall in love with him without using his powers. And Greg kind of gave you the blow-by-blow of the episode. One thing that he mentioned, though, that is very important to the episode is Jessica is starting to realize that nobody has ever really bothered to teach Kilgrave right from wrong. And so she actually takes him out crime-fighting, so to speak. They go out to try and resolve a hostage situation that they see on television. And Jessica is able to coach Kilgrave through a situation and help him to save lives. And they come back to the house, and Kilgrave is excited by it. He actually has gotten a rush from doing the right thing. And so Jessica tells him, you know, why don't you just go off on your own and help people instead of just using your powers for your own personal gain. And he reminds her that without her there, he would have just killed everyone and been done with it. And that she is the only thing that ties him to the moral side of the world, which is interesting coming for such a cynical person as Jessica Jones. And so just wanted to throw that back out there. But yes, as Greg said, it is tense, unlike just about any episode of the Marvel Netflix universe. Tenet gives an absolute tour de force of a performance, but Kristen Ritter matches him every step of the way. I have made no secret of the fact that I think Jessica Jones is not just the best of the Netflix shows, but one of the finest things Marvel has ever put on film, period. Whether that's a Marvel film, a Sony Marvel film, a Fox Marvel film, it is a masterpiece from beginning to end, in my opinion, and this is the high watermark of that 13-episode masterpiece. So WWJD for me is by far and away the number one episode of the Marvel Netflix universe.
It's definitely great. I loved everything about it. At my number two and my number one, Penny and Dime, to me were a cut above the rest of the list. Everything on the list I loved, but those two were all-timers that I would put up against the best things that Marvel has put out in animation or live action ever. So let's run down our list real quick, Nick, to remind people of these. At number 5, I had Daredevil, Speak of the Devil. At number 4, I had Luke Cage, Moment of Truth. At number 3, I had Daredevil, Stick. At number 2, I had Jessica Jones, a.k.a. WWJD. Or as Michael Cole would call it, WWJD. Daredevil. At number 1, I had Daredevil, Penny and Dime. You, Nick?
Yeah, at number 5, I had Jessica Jones, a.k.a. You're a Winner. At number 4, I had Daredevil in the Blood. At number 3, I had Jessica Jones, a.k.a. It's Called Whiskey. At number 2, I had Jessica Jones, a.k.a. Sinbin. And at number 1, I had Jessica Jones, a.k.a. WWJD.
Now, I can't be shocked, Nick, but you have 4 Jessica Jones episodes in your top 5. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, when I sat down to make my preliminary list, I think I had 6 episodes from Daredevil Season 1. I had 4 episodes from Daredevil Season 2. I had 3 episodes of Luke Cage, no Iron Fist, and the entirety of Jessica Jones to consider for my culling. And that is what I wound up with. The Luke stuff dropped pretty easy. The everything except Penny and Dime dropped pretty easy in Season 2. And I was left with, you know, the entirety of Jessica Jones, 6 episodes from Season 1 of Daredevil. And so I had a list of about 15 I was trying to cut down from. And as I made continually difficult decisions, it just became apparent to me that, you know, these Jessica Jones episodes, in my opinion, are on another level. They have an emotional and dramatic weight to them that just about anything else in the superhero genre has never approached for me.
Yeah, and that's fair enough, for sure. It's a great – you know, my delineation would be while – yeah, I mentioned this earlier. It's interesting that Daredevil cracked my list 3 times. And I've granted it's got an advantage because there's 2 seasons of it. But the other thing is that Jessica Jones is by far and away my favorite of the series to this point. I think it's the most consistent. I think it's the most engaging. And I think it's the only one of the series or the seasons that I've watched to this point that had a satisfactory final episode. I thought they really stuck the landing on Jessica Jones, and they kind of haven't on any of the other shows that I've seen to this point or seasons that I've seen to this point. But I think the difference for me is that Jessica is more of a Justice League season – what is it? Season – Justice League Unlimited season 2, I guess it was, or 1, where everything kind of flows into the next. And it's one – more so than the other shows, to me, Jessica feels like a coherent episode-long story that is being told. So it's harder for me to divide the individual episodes – than it is for something like Daredevil that I feel like it waxes and wanes, where you'll have a magnificent episode and then you'll have a dull episode and then you'll have a really good episode and then you'll have kind of an average episode. And that's kind of been the story of Daredevil with me, whereas Jessica was consistently very good the whole time through, but it was harder other than aka WWJD, it was harder for me to pick out individual episodes that stuck with me the way that something like Daredevil's best stuff has stuck with me.
Well, you also mentioned that Jessica was one of the only show, I think, of the Netflix shows that you pretty much binged over a weekend. So you compressed all that into a smaller time frame, and it kind of flows together. Whereas I watched Jones like an episode or two at a time over like a week, and so I kind of had it more staged out. So I guess they kind of stuck a little bit better in my mind as it pertains to the individual episodes.
Right. But a lot of good stuff there. And, you know, reading this this Daredevil stuff that is so great, it really makes me even more frustrated with the inconsistency of Season 2 because they got – for the most part, I think Season 1 was excellent, and it felt like they lost a little bit of that in Season 2. In terms of – even though I had a Season 2 episode on my list and a few others that were in consideration, the consistency just went out the window for me where there would be – 2 more so than 1 had that kind of wax and wane, if that makes sense, where it was up 1 week or up 1 episode, down the next episode, up the next episode. And I think that's a shame because Jessica Jones has proven that you can have that consistent high the whole season long and even Season 1 of Daredevil. So
Big fan of these. I don't think it's any coincidence that in my opinion, the 2 best seasons of the Netflix shows to date are the ones that do not adhere to the format they've used for Daredevil Season 2, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist, and those being kind of splitting the season up into two little mini story arcs by having different villains featured in the first half and the back half of each season, and kind of having, you know, six-episode arcs as opposed to 13-episode stories. I think Daredevil and Jessica Jones have proven that to this point, the 13-episode storytelling has been more successful for the Netflix shows than has the 6-to-7-episode storytelling.
Yes, and I have heard the theory purported that by some, I've heard it said by some, that the Netflix shows prove that maybe there's something to the idea of having shorter seasons to maintain a higher quality. And I would argue that I don't find that to be the case. I think the issue is less to do with how many episodes you have and more to do with the coherence of your connective story. And that's something that for as long as the seasons are, the CW shows usually do really well, is have a cohesive central villain that ties everything together and wraps up well. And the two best Netflix seasons to this point, to your point, Daredevil Season 1 and Jessica Jones Season 1, both had that as well. A central villain and a narrative through point that, while it may times shift to the background on occasion, it's there the whole time and it pays off at the end of the season. And I think both of us thought that in the case of Daredevil Season 2, there was no real payoff at the end of the season. At least what we were looking for. So
yeah, it was a very clear setup for Defenders, and it's one, as we'll discuss in the back half of the show with reading and watching. Greg, once you get around to watching Defenders, it will be a little bit frustrating seeing, even in the first two episodes, how much Daredevil payoff has saved for Defenders.
Excellent. With that being said, real quick, during the course of recording this, I actually solicited on Twitter. Anybody out there that's one of my followers that wanted to submit their favorite episode of the Marvel Netflix universe to this point, I did get two responses. It was very short notice. I should have done it earlier in the day, but I did get two responses. Wanted to read those out on the air. Number one comes from our good friend Andrew Chandler Fraser Garner, the 17th, and he says his favorite episode also comes from Jessica Jones. And it's Season 1, Episode 10, 1,000 Cuts. This is an episode in which – is this the episode, Nick, where the attorney's wife, who she wants to divorce her, ends up having to kill herself or being killed somehow? I can't remember. I feel like it has to do with the attorney.
Yeah, she is ordered – the doctor is actually ordered to attack attack Hogarth and cut her 1,000 times. And I don't remember exactly how they get there. Yeah, Kilgrave tells the doctor, the person who Hogarth is divorcing, to get her revenge by cutting her 1,000 times. And so she starts counting each strike. And this is where Pam, the sexy secretary, enters and hits the ex-wife in the head with a vase and kills her. And so it's kind of showing how Jessica and Kilgrave's conflict is causing not just problems for Jessica, but pretty much everyone around her. Their lives are quickly going to hell as a result of their association with Jessica. So it's a great episode for sure.
And Fletch F. Fletch on Twitter, handle at Jax_Fletch, has a great Skeletor picture as his profile. He submits to us his favorite episode, Daredevil Season 2, Episode 9. This is the episode called 7 Minutes in Heaven, and this one also came close to making my list. This is, as he puts it, Fisk and Castle in prison together, which is pretty apt description, because this is basically the Kingpin who's been imprisoned at the end of Daredevil Season 1, seeing an opportunity in Frank Castle and exploiting that opportunity, and it creates, or rather leads to, another one of the best scenes in the Marvel Netflix universe, and that is the prison fight where Frank Castle has to survive as he gets assaulted by all these prisoners and not only survives but beats the living daylights out of all of them. Yes, I've used that again. And ends up basically taking all of them out in badass fashion. This is probably the most quintessentially Punisher scene of the entire season. Would you agree, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned earlier that I kind of had narrowed down to 15 episodes I had to pick my five from, and this was definitely on that list of 15. One of the high points of Daredevil Season 2, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Well, that being said, folks, we'd love from you and get some more suggestions. Were there any episodes that you loved that we left off? Let us know. I am on Twitter at gphillips8652. He is on Twitter at nickduke87. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We would love to have you on there. We have lots of discussions there, some discussions there. It's kind of died out a little bit recently. We're trying to get it sparked up again, so please join. You can comment on this article on the PlaceToBeNation.com page. If you have a Dis account, please sign up for that and comment. Or you can shoot us an email, Greg P. at PlaceToBeNation.com, Nick D. at PlaceToBeNation.com. Hope you enjoyed this countdown. And if you do send us something after the fact, I will read it off on the air next week, and we'll have that discussion as well. With that being said – or sorry, not next week, the week after. Next week, something different. But with that being said, we're going to take a break, and when we come back on the other side, we're going to have reading, watching, and the rundown on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Coming soon from the creative minds of the Place to Be Nation Pop Network, the audio adaptation that no one was asking for, but everyone deserved. Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater presents Watchmen, an audio feast for your ears. Thrill to the exploits of the comedian.
These are demons. It's an intergalactic invasion into this space through people. They have sexual rituals, some of the most ancient Egyptian rituals, where they believe they are possessed by entities, space aliens.
Silk Spectre.
Good. Hey, licking your finger, it's like licking a battery. It's all sort of...
Night Owl.
Yeah, well, you know how it goes. Sometimes I come down here and sit around a little bit, think about the times when we were making the towns, doing the drugs, fucking the rats.
Dr. Manhattan.
Clearly, you don't really care about what stimulates me.
Ozymandias.
Puta, the Soviets, Vietnam, anyone? Mila Jovovich?
And Rorschach.
But what it doesn't change is the fact, and this is something we can all agree on, that all of the whores and politicians will look up and they'll shout, "Save us, JR," and I'll look down and I'll whisper, "Mom."
You won't believe your ears. You won't believe the dark places your imagination will take you. Featuring cameos from some of your PTBN favorites.
Baby, that's quite a drop, I said.
Oh, they're just paying me to handle monsters in outer space? No, no.
Maybe it was a couple of guys and they overpowered him.
He cometh up and swerve, cut down like a flower.
Fly me to the moon, let me fuck amongst my star. Oh, I guess Dr. Osterman finally arrived.
Remember this gimmick, guys.
Okay, number one, big blue dick. You don't bring it up. It's big, it's there, it's wagging.
It's Watchmen, the greatest graphic novel of all time, as you've never heard it before. Transformed into the most self-referential collection of in-jokes on this or any other medium. Only from the hard-traveling fanboys and Place to Be Nation Pop.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the hard-traveling fanboys. Countdown, and we hope you enjoyed the countdown portion of our broadcast, but now we're getting to the nitty-gritty. As a famed singer back in the late 80s once sang about, and I can't remember if it was Gloria Estefan or Paula Abdul, but one of them said that in a song, and nonetheless, how about that? How about I switch it up this week? How about I change to nonetheless? Am I becoming like 90s Vince McMahon,
Greg is upset because he was bitching a bit at me about all the work he has to do on the show before we started recording, how he has to, quote, host the show and handle all the transitions. And I'm like,
only because
by handling transitions, you just mean saying nevertheless about 30 times in every episode.
Only because Nick was bitching about having to find all the rundown topics. So we were bitching at each other.
That's right. And you countered with, "Oh, I plug the show. I'm a social media shill."
Right.
Good for you.
I'm the only one that does any promotional work.
And
the only one that does any promotional consideration.
And let's shoot, brother. What difference has it made?
Well, I don't know. I don't. Quite frankly, I don't have access to that information.
Well, quite frankly, unless you want to take full credit for that, never mind. Let's just move on. Let's just move on.
That notwithstanding, I feel like I'm coming 90s announcer Vince, though, with my nevertheless is my notwithstanding.
That's true, but who is your 1996 Shawn Michaels? That's what we got to figure out.
I don't know.
That's the key here.
That is the key. I don't know. I mean, maybe Stephen Amell, but maybe not. I don't know.
Stephen Amell, Dick Grayson, the character,
Jeff Johns,
yeah. I don't know. We got to figure that out.
I have yet found a person that just by mentioning the person's name causes me to erupt into fits of joyous laughter.
Greg, I don't think any person has ever found that outside of Vince McMahon.
No, he found a level of true love that no married couple has ever actually found.
I have kids, Greg, and I don't think my love for my children is as pure as 1990s announcer Vince's love was for 1996 Shawn Michaels.
Oh, yeah! Look at him! Oh, yes! Every week, man. Every week.
Oh, trust me. I've been doing the chronological rewatch lately, so I'm getting plenty of it. But we're wildly off topic once more.
What we're not getting plenty of to this point is Katie Sackhoff in comic book properties.
Wait, I thought we were doing – okay. What's happening right now, Greg?
The format sheet is being reversed, Nick, and we're going to start off with the rundown this week. We're starting off with that segment that I've already named called
– and started naming a story for, but here's the jingle anyway. It's the jingle for
– Welcome to the rundown.
The rundown. The rundown.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Katie Sackhoff has been a name that's been floated around by internet fans for quite some time.
Greg, it just occurs to me we didn't discuss any of these stories before we started recording, so are we just doing all of them?
You know?
Folks, if you,
might as well.
We've talked about the sausage being ate, but you are hearing it here in this week's episode.
Klondike. This is a Klondike Bill level of sausage being made right here.
Oh, God. Anyway, Katie Sackhoff, continue.
Yes. Now, I don't know much about Katie Sackhoff, Nick.
She was in Battlestar Galactica, which is a very popular show, but a show that I never watched. So people are excited about it. Good for them. She's playing a character on season 4 of The Flash, a character called a character that I've already forgotten the name of and that I had never heard of in the first place anyway. So I have nothing to offer about the character. I have nothing to offer about the actress. I'm glad people are excited, and that's all
she's
I have to say about that.
Amunet Black, a.k.a. Blacksmith.
Sure.
Who I believe is a Geoff Johns Flash character.
Absolutely.
And The Flash begins its fourth season October 10th on the CW network.
Woohoo!
Now, moving on, we got an announcement in the comic book world. That news came in the form of Green Lanterns, a book that both of us have had what I feel like, Nick, is an increasing amount of praise for since it started. Sam Humphries, unfortunately, has announced he's leaving the book. He's been the writer since the book launched at the beginning of the DC Rebirth Initiative in 2016. However, where one door closes, another opens. And in this case, it's Tim Seeley, who is known for his work on Grayson and currently Nightwing. He's been announced as the new writer of Green Lanterns. And the early solicitation for his November issues reveal that he is going to be going to a very familiar place for us, Mr. Duke. And that is he is going to be going to the stable and unleashing from that stable Balfunga the Unrelenting.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how this plays into Balfunga's recent appearance in Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, if the two tie together at all, or if they're just going to ignore that, because he played a pretty major role in the recent Fracture story. So interested to see how Jessica and Simon interact with Balfunga after the events of that story that kind of shook up the status quo for the Corps as a whole.
Yes, it also is interesting that Green Lantern is going more and more out into the cosmos a little bit, and this is going to see them going to another planet, and seemingly...
Oh, by the way, the title of this is amazing, Greg.
Are you referring to Oh, Balfunga, Where Art Thou?
Yes. Yes, I am. And now the entire thing is nothing but a Green Lantern version of Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes. Absolutely, with Green Lantern stand-ins. Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Who would be the Green Lantern Universe equivalent of Pappy O'Daniel Gubna?
Pappy O'Daniel Gubna would, of course. I'm trying to think. Maybe, maybe Ganthet would be Pappy O'Daniel Gubna.
I could see that, and if, and I really am married to the idea of Hector Hammond as Homer Stokes. Or would Hector Hammond be better as Vernon T. Waldrop?
Now, see, that's the thing, though. I would think that you would have Kyle and Hal as, you know, Kyle obviously would be Vernon T. Waldrop, you know, because he has taken Hal's woman from him in the past, and inevitably she winds up making the right decision and going back to the superior man.
Hal would be Everett, of course, in that case.
Of course.
And that would leave, I guess Guy would have to be Delmar, right?
Who's Big Dan Teague in this situation?
Big Dan Teague would be Kilowog.
Kilowog?
Yes.
Okay, I figured he would be villainous in some way, but I...
Oh, well, that's a good point. We have hijacked our own podcast, by the way, but I'm fine with it. Now I'm kind of married to the idea of casting O Brother Artha with Green Lantern characters. I feel like this will open us up to some good Twitter discussion, too. You know, if you wanted to go villainous with Big Dan Teague, maybe Arkillo.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I like it. I like it. I'm a fan.
Oh, who's going to play Pete, though, and get loved up and turned into a horny toad? Would that be John Stewart by default?
I guess it would have to be, yeah.
Do not seek the power battery.
But would we need to save John Stewart to play to play Tommy? Yeah. In all seriousness, Bullfunga would be outstanding as Babyface Nelson.
Yes. Oh, Bullfunga, not the livestock.
This is the point, Greg. It took us almost 70 episodes, but this is the point where David Sunday is going to his iTunes feed and deleting our podcast forever because of like uninterrupted "Oh Brother, Where Art Thou" discussion.
Delete, obsolete, delete, obsolete. Oh, good Lord, good Lord.
Yes.
I'm running down.
Nonetheless. All right.
Yes. Tim Seeley, you know, I'm not nuts about his God, on Austin Powers line. Anyway, I can't see his nuts, but I'm not nuts about his Nightwing run
to
this point.
You're not nuts about his dick?
To this point, I'm not nuts about his dick. But that being said, perhaps taking on two newer characters like Simon and Jessica could pay off in a big way. So I'm willing to give this a shot. And like you said, I love the title. I love the usage of Bullfunga. Willing to – say it with me, Nick. Let it play out
and
see where it goes.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like I haven't been overly impressed by much of anything he's done to this point. But it also – none of it has been like outwardly bad. You know, none of the stuff that I've read. So this title and these characters have a lot of momentum. And anything Green Lantern is always going to have a little bit of the benefit of the doubt with me. So I'm going to check this out. And if I wind up dropping it, I wind up dropping it.
Absolutely. Well, things that just don't seem to be getting a shot are several Hollywood properties, but in particular, one that has just can't get out of the gates is Channing Tatum's Gambit film. The famous star says that after 3 years of working on a Gambit film with 20th Century Fox, the production is, quote, starting over, end quote. In an interview with – I can't believe this is the name of a publication. Hey, you guys! The Magic Mike star said the original plans blew up, but the success of Deadpool and Logan have given this film a new path. Here's the quote from Channing Tatum. Quote, we lit a fuse on the first one and just blew it completely out of the water. I think we got lucky. We got hit with some setbacks, and it was all for a good reason. We were trying to do something completely different. We were trying to do something that this genre of movie hasn't seen before. We kept running into the same problems, and then Deadpool and Logan came through and kicked the doors down. Now we're all getting to do some of those things that we've always wanted to do with the script. We just sort of started over. End quote. Tatum, who is co-producing the film with 20th Century Fox, is looking for a director. This guy would be the third such director after the departures of Rupert Wyatt and Doug Liman. Nick, is this movie ever going to happen?
Yes, it'll happen at some point. I think 20th Century Fox has been so aggressive lately in expanding their X-Men franchise to include different concepts with just the core X-Men films, whether that be the Deadpool franchise, whether that be the X-Force movie that's planned, New Mutants, you know, things like that, that I think eventually this will happen at some point. I don't know if it happens in its current Channing Tatum attached form, but at some point it'll happen.
Yeah. I hope you're right, because while there are some anti-Gambites out there, I am a pro-Gambite.
As am I.
And have been since about, the summer of 1992.
Yep.
and I think Gambit is a character that does have potential. I think he is a character that a lot of people have an attachment to, who has not really been handled the best in the comics over the years, but a character that nonetheless has that – the same kind of appeal that Deadpool and Wolverine have. And I think Fox has found success by focusing on characters that provide something different to the superhero genre. They're not the dyed-in-the-wool heroics that you're used to. They've got either an edge to them or a anti-establishment deal to them or kind of a humorous take on them. It's just different. It's an alternative take on the superhero genre, because as we've seen, it's awfully hard to out traditional Marvel right now.
Right.
So they're really Marvel Studios, that is. So Fox is focusing on these. I think Gambit's a character that can work. I'm hoping that this gets out of the gates. I'm not convinced that it's going to happen like you are, Nick, but I hope it does. I'm rooting for this project to succeed.
Might I suggest a Louisiana set straight up heist movie? I think that would be the way to go with this one.
Are you suggesting throwing in the Thieves Guild?
That would be the route I would take. I mean, I don't know that you can take Gambit as a solo property and tie it overly heavily into the larger X-Men universe. You know, that might be a little strange, but having Gambit off in his own corner with the Thieves Guild doing something like that, I think would make a lot of sense. That, you know, there it being set in Louisiana, you can play off some of his childhood trauma and stuff like that. I think there's some interesting routes you can go there. And a heist movie, unless you count Ant-Man, hasn't really been done in this genre to this point.
Agreed. I will just say that if 20th Century Fox and Mr. Tatum are looking to pay someone a hefty sum of money to write the Gambit movie for them, I am available. However, I will offer the disclaimer that I will write Gambit to just use nothing but Jerry Lawler lines the whole time. In my mind, he's Cajun Jerry the King Lawler. So I'm just saying it could happen. It could happen, folks. And nevertheless, do you think we could start marketing when we start our pro wrestling tees?
Oh, we should get
website.
A Nevertheless t-shirt. Yeah,
that's a Nevertheless t-shirt.
Yep. That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
I think it can happen. Okay, so moving on to – oh, here it is, Nick.
Video game news.
Video game news.
Yes.
All right, let's move on to video game news. Heck Boy, your favorite hero and mine, is joining the
and
cast –
by Heck Boy, he means Hellboy.
Is joining the cast of DC's Injustice 2, or as some know it in Oklahoma, Injustice 2. He joins Mortal Kombat's Raiden and, most excitingly, DC's Black Manta as joining the cast of playable characters in Injustice 2. Nick, as someone who has the ability to actually play Injustice 2, how pumped are you about this announcement and a shock announcement that another comic book property from outside of DC's purview in Hellboy is coming into the game?
Yeah, that part is really cool. Not so much the Hellboy aspect of it itself, because I've never read any Hellboy and only seen, you know, the first Hellboy movie, never seen the second one. So I don't really have that much attachment to the character. But it's cool that at least the door is open now for DC and NetherRealm working with other comic book publishers, smaller publishers, to perhaps work some of those other characters in there. I have a hard time of thinking off the top of my head other characters that would be great fits, but at least the door is open now, so that's very exciting. And then, as you said, playing as Black Manta should be really cool, so there's that. But now I'll turn the floor back over to you so you can rant about Raiden being included in the DLC.
I will be the first to admit it. I can't claim to be an owner of the game because I don't have a PlayStation 4 yet, so I can't play it. And the mobile game ceases to be fun after a while. But again, why are people buying these games? Are they buying these games because it's basically another Mortal Kombat, or are they buying these games because it is a DC Comics fighting game? I argue that the vast majority of people that buy this game are buying it to play as DC Comics characters, not to play as Mortal Kombat characters, who they've been able to play as in, what, 10, 11 games at this point?
11, I believe, but don't – well, yeah. I it may be 12 if you count Mortal Kombat versus DC Universe.
Yeah, so as many as 12 – and as few or no lower than 10 times have people been able to play as these Mortal Kombat characters. It's happened. It's been there. It's done. I don't think that adding Raiden is going to sell a single extra copy of this game. But I do think that if they had included – oh, I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, and I'm not saying they should have actually included him. But Larfleeze, just as a random character off the top of my head, Guy Gardner, who else? Just characters from the DC Universe. God, there's so many of them that they could be in this game. Obscure villains like the Toyman, whichever version of the Toyman you want to use, one of his Superman, Batman robots, hybrid robots or something. You've got Hawkman could be in the game as a character. Adam Strange. There's so many different characters out there in the DCU. The Spectre would be an amazing character to add into the game. And I just don't get the benefit of continually adding Mortal Kombat characters. I'm not going to play as one of the Mortal Kombat characters when I get the game one day in the future. I didn't on the first Justice. And if you throw in one character, cool. But if you start throwing in two, three, one per DLC pack, to me that's just – at best it is – unnecessary, and at worst, it is deliberately misleading to the audience that bought the game when they were told they were getting DLC characters with it. That's just my thoughts on it, Nick. I know you disagree, but that's just my take.
I don't necessarily disagree. I don't agree as passionately as you do. Like I would prefer DC characters to take up every spot, but at the same time, of the two Mortal Kombat characters they've thrown in thus far, they are two of the ones that I would actually be interested in playing as. So I'm of two minds about.
The only Raiden I'm interested in is Christopher Lambert.
Christopher Lambert, huh? I wonder if he was any relation to terrible former George quarterback Grayson Lambert.
Ah, you loved you some Grayson Lambert.
Oh my God, don't even start with me. Don't even I loved Grayson Lambert the way you loved. Oh God, let me think of. I don't even know. I don't even know. I can't even think of Spencer Pennington. I remember him.
Yep. He couldn't throw the ball past 20 yards.
Oh.
By God, he had an awesome frat-tastic name.
I saw him get concussed live. I think, or I don't know if he got concussed, but he got the shit knocked out of him and taken out of the game. But we're getting off
topic
again.
Let's go to Gambit the King Lawler for comment. Her legs don't stop, but I like to be there when they do. I can read her like a book, Logan. I just prefer the Braille edition. That's a great Jerry Lawler line, damn it. The Braille edition. Oh God. He allegedly committed sexual assault at one point. Anyway.
Oh God.
Allegedly. Not saying it happened. But what does happen on frequent occasions, Nick, the DCEU corner.
DCEU corner.
Or in this case, not the DCEU corner? Not the
DCEU corner.
Like,
right.
I don't even know what to make of these two stories, Greg, so you take it away.
Let's take these one by one. Let's start with – well, they're both baffling, but let's start with perhaps the most baffling of the two. This is according to Deadline, which is pretty reliable. This is not random internet speculation. In an exclusive, Deadline is reporting that Warner Brothers and DC are in the early stages of yet another Batman Universe spinoff movie, this one telling the origin story of the Joker. The studio is at the hangovers Todd Phillips to co-write a script, my God, with 8 Mile scribe Scott Silver.
Oh, good Lord.
Phillips will also direct the movie, and Martin Scorsese will produce it. Can we switch them? Can we switch those two people, their roles? This will be the first film.
How did Martin Scorsese get hooked up with Todd Phillips, of all people?
Why does Martin suddenly care about the Joker? This will be the first film under a new banner that has yet to be named, in which WB can expand the canon of DC properties.
Wait!
And
they can't... Huh? Okay.
I think it's just a misuse of the word canon.
Okay, let's
DC
hope.
Properties and create unique storylines with different actors playing the iconic characters. I am told, and this is per the Deadline reporter, so don't give us the heat, people, if this is wrong. It's Mike Fleming Jr., a Deadline reporter.
Don't tweet us at JR's BBQ.
That's right. And don't visit the world's loneliest website. And tell us. I'm told that the intention is to make an origin story that isn't part of any other iteration. The Joker, of course, has really been part of 2 Batman movies in the form of Jack Nicholson and Heath Ledger, and was most recently played by Jared Leto in the first Suicide Squad. He will reprise this in the Suicide Squad sequel and the Harley Quinn spinoff, but the new film will launch the character with a different actor, possibly younger. The intention is to make a gritty and hard-boiled crime film set in the early 80s Gotham City that isn't meant to feel like a DC movie as much as one of Scorsese's films from that era, like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, or The King of Comedy.
But
I'm told that Phillips and Silver are writing already, but there is nothing firm on where this will fit into the DC schedule. Phillips most recently directed War Dogs with Jonah Hill and Miles Teller.
Oh.
Silver's recent fight scripts include The Fighter, which is a great movie.
Okay.
No more info on this. So, Nick, what does all this mean? I'm gonna lay out for a minute because I don't know what any of it means.
I have no idea what any of this is about. Let's take this in order. Todd Phillips, of all people, which I understand he has started to make the foray into some more dramedy type territory rather than straight up comedies like Old School and The Hangover, which is kind of where he built his reputation originally. And that's fine, you know, whatever. I have no strong feelings about him as a director, but pairing him with...
He also wrote Borat.
Todd Phillips wrote Borat?
Apparently, that's what it says here. He's listed as a writer on Borat.
Well, 95% of Borat was improvised, but...
Yeah.
Anyway, we're getting off topic. The point being, Todd Phillips paired with Martin Scorsese seems like a really weird pairing, and I don't know if it's going to wind up being... compatible in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Also, the very idea of this movie, a DC film that is not taking place in the DCEU. Okay.
So something like an Elseworlds movie. Let's think of it that way.
An Elseworlds movie. Okay, but Greg, weren't we told that wasn't the report that the reason why we lost the Suicide Squad characters in the CW-verse is because they wanted to avoid brand confusion with the big screen versions of those characters?
Yes.
So now, rather than...
That's what we were told by all the actors involved and all of the Arrow people involved, although the studio people have denied this. So,
okay.
Believe who you will. I know who I believe in that scenario.
I do too. So let's just assume that everyone listening is a rational person and is believing the television side. So, if that's the case, why why would DC Films now be creating separate versions of the same characters and expecting, like, you and I will have no problem understanding these are separate and unrelated. Trying to explain that to a casual audience is going to be a little bit of a tougher sell. To
no,
say
no, no, no. That's the Earth 314 Joker.
Yes. And
totally different.
Completely different. And not to mention, yes, there are Elseworlds stories in the comics. And yes, they have gone down this road before in the comics in non-canon type stories. But I am of the opinion that, generally speaking, the Killing Joke being the one and only exception in my view, attempting to tell a Joker origin story is a bad idea in general. Yep. It never works out. It takes away what makes the character special. And even if this isn't part of the DCEU, people are now going to think that this movie is an origin story for Jared Leto's take. This makes zero sense, Greg. No sense whatsoever.
I am fine with the idea of doing Elseworlds movies. I don't have an issue with that. But I think when Elseworlds movies and you haven't even established your own universe yet.
Yes.
Big issue. We're going to get a damn joke. There's a chance, Nick. Now, it's not set in stone, but there is a chance. And the fact that there's even a chance pisses me off that we could get a Joker movie before we ever get a Green Lantern movie again.
Yep.
You know, it's – I don't like this. Elseworlds movies are fine down the line. And here's the thing. This could turn out to be an amazing movie given – I mean, I love everything I read about it. A gritty urban movie taking place in the early 80s, a great setting, Scorsese feel to it. But is it something that we really want to see right now, and does it fit with what they're trying to do? And I don't see how it does, and I don't see how – again – if you're doing a Batman movie in that environment, maybe. But the Joker is not a character that is served by giving away the story.
And if you do this, you better have a massive public relations campaign / public education campaign to make it blatantly obvious to everyone who could potentially see this film, buy a ticket, or even watch it on Netflix that this is not related to your larger connected universe. You better go out of your way to beat people about the head and neck area with that fact, because I'm telling you, there will be people who go watch this and will not understand that.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, we've already gotten we even got it as far back as, people speculating that Man of Steel was still taking place in the Christopher Nolan universe, and that had to come out and be refuted, distinctly refuted. There was talk about, every one of these characters that pops up, of how are they tied into older versions of the characters. People always want to create their own headcanon for these movies, and that's a battle you're facing anyway. But when you're compounding that by presenting simultaneous movies, and then when you're, violating your own protocol on that,
yeah.
Because, if that's the case, then why the hell did Arrow have to abruptly kill off Amanda Waller when she was a character they were clearly building towards bigger things with for so long? Who knows, man? But from one who knows to another who knows. As we got an update on the Batman and a bit of news that came out just today that is shocking, to say the least. The Batman director, Matt Reeves, made some comments on the podcast The Business, which is about the movie industry, that have gotten people stirred up. And it may be a case of reading too much into the comments. I kind of tend to think that's the case, but here's what he says. Quote, "I have a vision for a way to do something with that character that at least feels like it resonates with me personally, that could grow outward into other things. When they approached me, they said it's a standalone thing. This isn't part of an extended universe." Wow. Maybe that's not reading too much into the comments. This would contradict previous reports. This is outside the quotes. This would contradict previous reports that the Batman would connect to the DCEU, including the character's appearances in Batman v Superman Justice, Suicide Squad, and the upcoming Justice League. However, it may put the film in line with the recently reported Joker origin film, which is said to stand alone from the DCEU and the first in a line of unconnected features. Reeves also seemingly confirmed that the Batman would kickstart a trilogy of Batman films, though he later contradicted that statement by saying they're not saying it's going to be a trilogy either. When Masters reminded him of the previous exchange, he responded, perhaps jokingly, "I don't know how you knew that." Reeves described his vision as a golden age noir style story that would challenge Batman's perspective on what it means to do good in a corrupt world. Reeves brought up an interest in Catwoman, asking Matt, the host of the podcast, "What about Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman? I'm just saying she was incredible." When Masters asserted that her favorite Batman was Michael Keaton. He also said he felt that The Dark Knight was primarily defined by the Joker's perspective, while his film would get more inside Batman and that perspective. So, good Lord, man. Are we going to get a Batman standalone film with Ben Affleck that is not tied to the other movies where Batman is already played by Ben Affleck?
I don't know. I
What does it all mean, Basil?
The only thing I can think that can even possibly make this make the slightest bit of sense, Greg, is what if my theory from a couple weeks ago about Flashpoint being used as a way to kind of reset the main continuity is something they wind up doing. Let's say they do. And let's say they use that as a vehicle to de-age Batman and recast the DCEU version of Batman, as was so heavily rumored. And so the main DCEU version of Batman would be a different Batman than this one, and this would now be one of those Elseworlds-type movies. Is that possible? I mean, like, is it possible that Ben Affleck saying, "Hey, I'm going to play Batman in the Batman," and the report about Warner Brothers wanting to replace Ben Affleck, is it possible they both were true? I don't know. I don't know what to make any of this.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I think that all of this points to, Nick, perhaps, maybe I'm way off base here, I think this might add more fuel to that fire that Flashpoint could be a soft reboot and get us, you know, maybe the main, quote, DC, Batman and Superman, all that stuff, maybe they get recast or Batman gets recast anyway, and you get a soft reboot there, and then Affleck still gets to play Batman in these standalone features. I don't know. But all I know, Nick, is it's a mess. I'm not going to say it's a mess. It seems from the side, looking into this situation, according to some industry insiders, to be the potential is there anyway for it to be something not unlike what could be a character mess.
Yeah, I completely agree, JR. And again, all these plans and all these bizarre, like, wheels in motion. What happens if Justice League is a bomb? I know I keep harping on that, but I think the more these weird stories about them trying to do, unconnected DC movies that are not connected to the DCEU, does it not make you wonder if the studio is concerned about the DCEU as a storytelling entity right now?
Yeah, I mean, what I want somebody to do is to tell me why. Tell me why, damn it. And the answer to why right now is we don't know. We don't know what all this means. We don't know what Matt – it makes it seem as if the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. That's what it makes it seem like to me.
And that's really unfortunate, because the idea when Jeff Johns and John Berg – were installed as, kind of DC Films overlords, is that we were going to start to have some of that oversight that Kevin Feige has over at Marvel Studios. And it felt like with Wonder Woman and Justice League coming back to back that maybe we were going to start to get that kind of shared vision and things were going to start to build. And now with all these reports, it makes you wonder if that's the case at all. I don't know, man. I really don't.
Yeah, it's curious, and hopefully they can get things together and on track and get us in a direction that is led by Wonder Woman and, leading in a direction of good solid movies that tie together and create a fun universe the way that Marvel has. Or disconnect the whole thing and just make standalone good movies.
Oh, but wouldn't that be like
– It would suck. It would be throwing in the towel. But the one thing I don't want is I don't want Wonder Woman to be dragged down by
I agree, but like – it's almost like we've crossed the line now in the genre that it's hard to go back from. Like,
you're right.
Now that we know it's possible and now that we know it can be done successfully, it's disappointing if DC can't figure this thing out, you know?
Yep. Yep. I agree. And at this point, Nick, I remember when we first started this podcast, one of the points that we hammered on a lot, and even on prior podcasts that we did, but when we were still doing the column, we hammered on the point that why won't DC just integrate the TV universe into the movie universe? Isn't it a good thing now in hindsight that they didn't?
Yeah. I guess. I don't know, man.
Because I feel instead of it being a situation of the rising tide of TV lifting the movies, I feel like it would have been the other way around, and it just would have dragged down what we're getting on TV. So – maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it would have elevated things. And obviously I wish for those actors they could get that shot to be on the big screen. But, you know, right now it feels like as DC fans, we need to enjoy what we're getting in the TV land and enjoy what we got from Wonder Woman and, you know, hope for the best from Justice League and from Aquaman. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's still much in flux. We'll see how it all turns out. Again, I don't want to be negative. Hopefully all of this turns out great. Hopefully Justice League's good. I do think Aquaman's going to be really good. So we'll see when we get to that point. But that's the end of the rundown. A lot of stuff this week, folks. A lot of interesting things. Hit us up. Let us know your thoughts on all these issues. Well, since we've done the rundown, we've done countdown, that means there's only one thing left to do, and that is
reading and watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Reading and watching. And I only have one comic book that I've read this week, Nick. So I'm going to go ahead and give my thoughts on this book. It is Aquaman and His Noble Seahorse, number 16, Peace in Our Time, by Dan Abnett and Brad Walker. This is the first issue following the cataclysmic events of the Deluge. It introduces a brand new character, a villain, a character heel known as Warhead, and some interesting character designs here in the book. And it basically sets the stage for what's to come. It's a little bit of a slowdown issue where we see the rebuilding efforts after what happened in the Deluge. We see the revelation that Arthur's cop friend from back home, she's had a crush on him since they were in school, but now she's kind of afraid of him because the Deluge has made her realize exactly what he's capable of and how powerful he truly is. Get some relationship drama with Arthur and Mira and how she is afraid because Queen – because of the prophecies she's seen. Really good stuff here. Again, it's hard to match up to the kind of nonstop action that was the Deluge, but this issue is a great and needed slowdown of focus on the characters of Arthur's world and setting up what promises to be a compelling and seemingly telepathic villain who's targeting Arthur's mind, it seems, over his body. So very excited to see this going.
Yeah, glad to hear you're continuing to enjoy Aquaman. So I'll run through, you know, again, I am still way behind. I'm reading a lot of books, but reading so many that I'm not gonna do the quick hits this week. So I'm just going to hit you with my bottom one and my top three real quick. Starting off with my number three book of the week, I've got DC Comics Dark Knights Metal, number one. I kind of jumped ahead and read this one a little bit ahead of some of the other books that have been in my stack a little bit longer because I heard so many great things about it, and it mostly lived up to the hype. Great art from Greg Capullo, as is to be expected. Great story from Scott Snyder that kind of wraps, you know, throughout all of DC lore and history and kind of encapsulates pretty much everything Scott Snyder has been involved with at DC to this point, kind of touching on so many different things. And you can hear a more detailed plot breakdown on the latest PTB Pop Blast, where Russell Sellers and Todd Weber discussed this book in depth. But very much enjoyed it. It's my number three book of the time period. Moving on to my number two book, I've got Batman 29. This continues the War of Jokes and Riddles storyline, and this kind of sees Bruce Wayne, not Batman, but Bruce Wayne attempting to broker a peace between the warring Joker and Riddler factions by having this really cool dinner summit with both of them and their respective lieutenants and whatnot. And it's just kind of, the book takes place over this dinner. It's an extended conversation. It's very decompressed storytelling. You know, I'm a big fan of that. So very much enjoyed this one. I continue to think that Tom King writes a better Riddler than just about anybody I've ever read. It's an outstanding characterization, and even the Joker is starting to pick up a little bit of steam. Still not a great version of the Joker, but better than it was when this story started. And then finally, Greg, my number one book of the week by a wide margin, and it is only appropriate given the fact that we discussed the television version of this character so much in the first half of the episode. I've got Jessica Jones, number 11. I've mentioned many times how this book really feels like a true continuation of the old Alias series from back in the early to mid-2000s with Brian Michael Bendis, Michael Gatos, and David Mack. And anyone who has read that comic before knows that one of the storytelling devices it would use is it would have Bendis, Gatos, and Mack telling the story in the present day, and occasionally it would flash back to Jessica's prior attempts at being a costumed hero. And whenever it would do that, it would actually switch art styles completely. It would go from this really surreal, you know, this really realistic noir style artistic approach to a very bright comic book style approach with Mark Bagley as the artist. And here we get to see a return to that attempt at storytelling. This book has Bendis telling a story of Jessica Jones investigating Maria Hill's past and her finding this file that has potentially some damaging revelations about Maria Hill's character and kind of why she finds herself hunted down by S.H.I.E.L.D. at the current moment. And so you have the story being told of Jessica doing the investigation and finding the file. And then when she and Maria are talking about what was in the file, it swaps all of a sudden. And the art style swaps, Greg, right down to the lettering and the way the pages are presented, even with a white border around all the pages, to a straight-up 1960s/70s Strange Tales Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. style of art with Javier Pulido of Hawkeye fame taking over the artistic duties. And it swaps hard and fast, and it's amazing. It was mind-blowing when I read it. It looks just like one of the Strange Tales Nick Fury stories. It is outstanding.
Maybe it looks like something that our old pal @FakeStarenko would draw.
FakeStarenko would absolutely love this. But yeah, it's really cool how Bendis goes back to that storytelling technique and just continues to make this book feel even more like a continuation of Alias from all those years ago. And for that little bit and that brilliant piece of artistic presentation, Jessica Jones, number 11, is my number one book of the week.
There you have it, folks. And that is the completion of reading. But we have watching.
Wait a minute. I didn't do my bottom book of the week, right?
Oh, that's right. I forgot. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, sir. I didn't mean to cut you off in the past.
And my bottom book of the week is one, it's a book that I know for a fact you and I are going to have very different feelings on. And this is Superman number 28. This is part two of the Declaration storyline. I talked about this a couple podcasts ago about how this is the first issue of the story was one that I found myself having trouble with because it was highlighting some of those, in my opinion, overly optimistic, overly naive aspects of the character of Superman. And it continues into this issue, and this issue is actually even more so for me. It's just so overly sincere in everything it is doing, and I know it sounds weird to complain about that, but it made me almost like uncomfortable while I was reading it because I found myself like I was like, who talks like this? Who says such just like who writes basically American patriotism nonstop for 30 pages? No one does this, and I just I don't know. I did not enjoy this one at all, but I have a feeling I'm going to be in the minority on this one. So Superman 28 is my bottom book of the week.
Curiouser and curiouser. Whispering Bill Anderson once wrote a song about this. Partner?
Your country music references actually made me remember a comparison I thought of. This two-part Superman story is the comic book equivalent of Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. That's pretty much what it is. It is wearing its cheesy patriotism on its sleeve.
Lee Greenwood.
There you are.
Little aside, folks, a little bit of personal information here. The Phillips grandparents clan, actually the Keller grandparents, often loved to go over to the gambling boats over to Biloxi, or just across the way from Mobile, and watch Lee Greenwood perform. And they would do this probably 6 or 7 times a year throughout the late 90s and early 2000s. The more you know. But what I was about to do, Nick, when I was cut you off there a minute ago, is I've just I have just viewed a tweet that I feel I need to report to our loyal listeners. Perhaps some of them will get, some of them will not get, and other even more than that will just look on in disgust at their podcast screens. So Tony Schiavone, friend of the show, has tweeted out a picture of a combination Klondike bar and Mrs. Fields cookie that has been released, apparently, a wrapper that is sitting on a table. And he says, Klondike on top of Mrs. Fields, Bill would have liked it. good stuff. All right. Well, that wraps up reading and watching, or reading part of reading and watching. What you been watching, Nick?
The only thing I've been watching, as I mentioned earlier, is I started and completed the first 2 episodes of Marvel's The Defenders on Netflix. I will keep my thoughts brief because I know you're trying to get caught up on your Netflix stuff so that you can hopefully start this one in the next few months. But I will say, be prepared for a slow burn. 2 episodes in, we have not yet seen these 4 characters on the screen at the time. It is definitely taking its time. Selling and telling a story. Not in a hurry to get where it's going, but you do get...
Would Cowboy be proud of it?
I think Cowboy would be proud of it. But the first episode is mainly focused on picking up where each of the respective seasons left each of our characters and kind of starting to move them, you know, in the case of, you know, certain characters, starting to move them back into a place where they can be an active part of the story. Don't want to say too much because I know you haven't watched Major Iron Fist about what that exactly that means, but getting those characters back on the board, getting these characters in a position where they can potentially interact with one another, and slowly but surely setting up Sigourney Weaver's Alexandra and kind of what her deal is and what she is seeking to accomplish and seemingly the hints about what her true nature is. So it's a very slow build throughout episode 1, which I will admit is just okay. But episode 2 is fantastic as the plot starts to pick up a little bit and you start to see each of these characters pulling on these what seem to be disparate strings of things that are going on in their respective boroughs of Manhattan or boroughs of New York City. But we all know as the viewer that they are connected somehow, and you start to see these characters slowly inching towards one another, including the first meetings of Luke Cage and Danny Rand and the first meetings of Jessica Jones and Matt Murdock. So we have seen the pairs meet up. We have not yet seen all 4 of them on the screen at the same time. But I very much enjoyed that second episode. I think I very much enjoyed it mainly because it feels like through the first 2 episodes that we've gotten more Jessica and more Matt than we have Luke and Danny. And that is kind of my preferred ratio for this show. I know a lot of people have complained about the amount of Iron Fist that is in this thing. And perhaps hearing those complaints made me fear for the worst, but honestly, through 2 episodes, I felt like they've kind of minimized Danny as much as they could, which is for the best. And so, I'll say so far good, and I'm looking forward to finishing off the last 6 episodes as soon as I get a chance.
Let us hope that the show doesn't fall victim to the recent Marvel Netflix trend of going to a time limit draw and failing to have a definitive ending to the contest.
We shall see.
As for me, I haven't been watching much since we watched Emerald Knights last week, comic book related. I have watched, however, a lot of pro wrestling, and Sunday night I got to see as my two loves crossed over briefly as the New Day of Xavier Woods, Big E, and Kofi Kingston made their entrance at WWE SummerSlam in Red Lantern-inspired attire. Check this out, folks. Go on the internet and Google it. It's great. Love those guys, and it was nice to see a little bit of love thrown the way of the Red Lanterns. Other than that, I ain't been watching jack. So, with that being said, that's the end of reading and watching. Oh, and next week is the big one, folks. Next week could possibly surpass our podcast from last December and become
the biggest podcast ever in Place to Be Nation pop history.
That's because we are going to present to you PTBN Pop Theater. We are turning into thespians. We are bringing to you the theater of comic books. And we are taking the greatest graphic novel of all time, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen, and we are twisting it. We are perverting it. We are stretching it, and we are expanding it into our own. Nick, what can we expect from this broadcast next week?
You know, life-changing material. A performance so great it will make Gandhi look like a child pornographer, I think is the best way to describe it. A series of performances, in fact. Not the least of which, and I can go ahead and throw some heap some praise. I have heard the rough cut, Greg, and I gotta say, my co-host, Greg Phillips, his turn of as J.R. Shack is going to go down in comic book lore as perhaps the finest portrayal of any comic book character in any medium. And I can't wait for you all to hear it. And so much so that we're not even going to talk about September. We don't want to distract you with what's coming down the pike.
No.
We want all your focus for the next 2 weeks to be squarely on comic book theater.
And we've got performances that you're not going to believe, whether it's a Fergusonian take on Dan Dreiberg, whether it is a very unique take on Hollis Mason that you'll just have to hear to place. We've got an uncomfortable sex scene or two. We've got, you know, there's just so much here to enjoy, and we think that when you hear it, you'll agree with us that Moore and Gibbons' classic comic is no longer relevant. This is now going to be the definitive Watchmen.
I agree, Greg. I agree wholeheartedly.
And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, let us bring this episode to a close. And please let us know your thoughts on the Marvel Netflix universe, the craziness with the DCEU, anything and everything that's on your mind. Let us know at the previously mentioned social media outlets. We'll get back to you, possibly even read your feedback on the show. Until next time, folks, so long, everybody! It's the greatest show in Place to Be Nation. Certainly a unique situation. Ooh, I travel fanboys.
Are you you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Close enough to slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question. Give me a minute. Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well-kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
Thank you.